As viruses multiply, they can mutate. And now there's a growing body of research that suggests an early mutation made the coronavirus more contagious and difficult to stop. We're exploring what mutation means for infection, transmission, virus development. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, what do you want to know about how RNA viruses mutate? What questions do you have about the variant in Wuhan, China, as compared to other parts of the world? It's 800-642-1234. Emily Bruce is a faculty scientist in virology at the University of Vermont's Lerner College of Medicine. Emily, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, happy to be here.
So RNA viruses, like the flu and measles, they're more prone to changes and mutations compared to DNA viruses. The coronavirus being an RNA virus, are we dealing with mutations here?
So we are dealing with mutations. And the important thing to keep in mind is that that's a normal thing for RNA viruses. Because of the way they replicate their genetic material, they're not as good at catching errors that happen in that process as, say, the cells in our body are, that have a whole set of specialized machinery that looks for errors that are made when you're copying that material and has the ability to correct them. And so, as a whole, RNA viruses mostly lack the ability to fix those kinds of typos. The coronaviruses are actually a bit of an exception in that they do have some ability to fix that kind of error, but still on the whole, they're an RNA virus, and so they can, just as a normal kind of course of doing business, develop small errors that get perpetuated in each cycle of replication. And because they replicate in an exponential fashion, so each virus that infects a cell will go on to make thousands of new virus particles, you can accumulate those kinds of errors relatively rapidly, just because you're making so many new viruses each time.
Yeah, so once an RNA virus makes contact with its host, it starts to make new copies of itself, and that can go on, you know, to infect other cells. What happens when a virus mutates? What is going on within that virus?
So it's kind of like if you make a typo when you're writing something in Word, and let's say you have the spell check function turned off. So sometimes that typo isn't really important at all. You have an extra space in between your words, and it doesn't really change your message at all, and most people wouldn't even pick up that it's there. Lots of mutations that happen are like that. They don't have any functional effect on the virus. And then sometimes you could think that you might make a change when you're typing that makes a little bit of a change, and someone could notice, you know, a word is spelled wrong, but people still understand your meaning, and it doesn't change your message at all. And those are the common kinds of changes. But then occasionally, you could have a change that really changes the whole meaning of your message. If you misspelled an important word and made it into a different word, and you changed the whole meaning of the phrase. And so you can see kind of if you see about, like, if you're writing those things down in your normal typing software, you can see that last kind of error, again, is going to be the most rare. But again, that's the kind that we're most concerned about, where you have a change that, in the case of the virus, this would be something that makes a significant biological change and isn't the equivalent of a typo or an extra space in your words.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. So there was a mutation in the coronavirus early on in the course of the pandemic. What do you know about this mutation? Did it make it easier to spread the virus from person to person?
So this was a mutation, D614G, that people noticed early on in the pandemic, and particularly they noticed in sequencing data from different places that this was becoming a much more frequent change that was being seen. And because scientists on a whole are really quite a cautious lot, for a long time people weren't necessarily convinced that they were seeing it more often because it was actually more transmissible, because there's other reasons you could see that. And so early on in the summer, you know, the other reason that people thought could be at play is simply something that we would call a founder effect, where the first person to fly to a new area and start a new outbreak kind of by chance, because they were the first person who got on a plane to that particular city, maybe they had this one typo. And because of the fact that they were in the right place at the right time, that would then be in all the viruses that propagated from that point onwards. And so those kinds of things can happen too. And really, it wasn't until we got a lot of different lines of biological evidence that started to indicate that this mutation actually does increase transmissibility that I think most of the people in the field came to the conclusion that this was a change that did actually have biological effect. And one of the most convincing experiments in support of that was a really elegant piece of work done by Ralph Barrick's group. And they're longtime coronavirus experts far before this pandemic started. But they used a technique called reverse genetics, where they made a virus that had only that mutation changed. So they had the what we call the wild type virus, or the parental strain that was circulating. And then they made a single change at that exact spot. And then they took the pair of those viruses. So they have a really nicely controlled system. And they put them both into pairs of hamsters. And the way they set this experiment up, the hamsters were in cages that were next to each other. So there was airflow in between them, but the hamsters couldn't touch each other. And they looked to see if the hamster that was infected was able to transmit virus to the pair in the neighboring cage. And they saw that none of the pairs that were infected with wild type virus transmitted virus to their neighbor, but five of the eight pairs that had the 614G mutant were able to transmit. And so that's the kind of evidence that does really indicate that the virus with that mutation does have a leg up in transmitting through that kind of route.
We're talking with Emily Bruce, who's a faculty scientist at the University of Vermont. We're looking at virus mutation and what it means for how we approach the coronavirus pandemic. You can join in with your questions about how viruses mutate. What do you want to know about the D614G? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Emily, is it surprising that the coronavirus mutated in such a way that it became more transmissible? Or isn't that not too significant upon itself?
So it's not terribly surprising, because when you think about it, viruses introduce lots of these kinds of changes, and the ones that have changes that make it easier for the virus to spread from cell to cell or spread from animal to animal will be the ones that are selected for, and that's kind of natural selection at work. The ones that are fittest will have a better chance of going on and propagating in the next host. So that on its own isn't terribly surprising, in that is kind of what viruses do. That's what that's their MO.
Yeah.
But the other thing I think it's important to mention, I wanted to put in here, was that while this mutation makes the virus slightly more transmissible, it's not the reason why the pandemic is the way it is, because all of the precautions that work against the parental strain of SARS-CoV-2 also work against this mutation. So it doesn't mean that the virus can escape around masks, or that it can survive hand washing measures, or that it can transmit, you know, through great distances outside. It gives it a little bit of advantage in closed indoor situations where people aren't masked and there's a lot of people in a closed space. And that's what all the, you know, strains of this virus like. But all the precautions that that we've been recommending against the original strain, they all still work. And so this is still something that is totally handleable. It's just all of the same measures in place.
The coronavirus will continue to change. We're learning about virus mutation with University of Vermont virologist Emily Bruce. What questions do you have about gauging a virus's transmissibility? Are you concerned that a COVID vaccine can keep up with the virus mutating? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Emily Bruce here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about coronavirus mutations and how scientists study and evaluate their effect on the nature of this pandemic. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One thing that will drive the future of the COVID-19 pandemic is how the virus evolves. And recently, scientists discovered evidence that the virus evolved to be slightly more transmissible early on. What questions do you have about virus mutation? What about the virus jumping to bats or other animal hosts? It's 800-642-1234. We have University of Vermont faculty scientist Emily Bruce is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Franco is with us from Oxford. Hi, Franco.
Hi, good morning, Kate and Emily. My question for Emily is, it's rather a simple one, but I never really was sure. As a virus such as the coronavirus spreads through the communities and out the world, throughout the world, does it get less and less weak as weaker or weaker? Like, it gets less and less deadly as it goes on and on before a vaccine? God bless it.
Mm-hmm.
Good question, Franco.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there isn't necessarily a hard and fast rule because it's kind of, it's predicting how evolution is at play. And basically, viruses don't have, you know, they're not thinking, but if you think about it in that kind of way, you know, what they want to do is they want to make more copies of themselves and they want those copies to go on and be successful. And so successful for a virus is simply that more copies are being made and they're being propagated. It's not necessarily, the virus doesn't, you know, it doesn't have intentional malice where it's like better if it makes people sick. It actually, in many cases, is more successful if it's able to spread without causing really severe disease, because that means that people are still up and about and going to work and going to school and they're not lying on the couch.
They're spreading it more.
Exactly. And that is one of the things I think that actually has made this virus so successful at spreading as a pandemic, is that people are at their most infectious before they're symptomatic. And so before people realize they're sick is when they're spreading the most amount of virus. And that is one of the things that has made it just so hard to control. Fortunately, though, there isn't any rule that, as viruses mutate and spread throughout the community, they become more dangerous. And so fortunately, that isn't something that we've seen happen here.
Franco, thanks. Let's bring in Andrew now from Eagle. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. What is your question about virus mutation?
So I had seen an interview with Dr. Francis Boyle earlier this year, and he was talking about gain-of-function viruses. And I was curious, with the rate of mutations that this virus has had, do you believe that there is some sort of gain-of-function built into this virus, and that's why the mutation rate is so high?
So I guess I would want to define what you mean by gain-of-function more precisely, because I'm not sure that I understood fully. I think, to answer a first part, and I'm kind of guessing here, there isn't anything engineered in this virus that makes it acquire mutations more quickly or become more dangerous more quickly. Gain of function is also a specific term that virologists often use when they're referring to testing a mutation by making that change with a system called reverse genetics, where we make a change and there's a specific set of oversight that looks at if you're making a mutation to a virus that is suspected to cause a gain of function and to make that virus more transmissible or more deadly. And there's additional special oversight about making those mutations and deciding on whether they should be made and how they should be handled for biosafety reasons, and also the publication of that information. So I think it's one of those terms that might mean different things to different people. There's nothing engineered. There's no evidence that there was anything engineer that this is anything other than a naturally arising virus that's acquiring mutations at the rate that we would expect it to.
An alarming development last month and earlier on in the pandemic was the transmission to mink and animals. What do you see there?
So there, I think, I'm not fully caught up on the entire story. I know essentially the worry is that if the virus transmits to another mammal host, that it can develop different mutations that might make it more dangerous and more transmissible. And coronaviruses can transmit into multiple other kind of intermediate species, whether that is kind of a dead-end host where, you know, the lion at the Bronx Zoo got infected, but that lion was probably not going on to infect, you know, everyone at the zoo, or whether it's something where you can have a lot of changes occurring more rapidly, is something that you need more research to work out. I think clearly in that case, they were concerned about that happening, and that's why a large number of mink were culled. But it's something we have to kind of constantly evaluate.
We're talking with Emily Bruce, who's a faculty scientist at the University of Vermont. We're looking at virus mutation and vaccine development with you at 800-642-1234. Emily, let's look at the COVID-19 vaccine horizon here. Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines are both mRNA vaccines. This is relatively new technology. How does it work?
So it essentially works by giving your body the instructions to make a protein that is found on the outside of the virus particle. And so it's called the spike protein, and it's kind of the equivalent of the key that gets the virus into a lock on the surface of a cell to be able to get inside and infect. And so the way vaccines work is often by targeting that outside protein, because it's the first thing that the body will see. And so if you essentially show a picture of that protein to your body, the same way that Hagrid taught the castle doors at Hogwarts to recognize Sirius Black by showing them a picture.
I love your analogies.
Yeah, where you give your body kind of a warning and show it a picture, and you're like, all right, if you see this, you need to kick into gear and, you know, fire up your whole immune system so you can go get it. And so that's the general principle of vaccines. The way that mRNA vaccines are different is just that instead of having to make the proteins or make the virus and inactivate it, you can simply give the body the string of letters that lets it make the protein on its own. So the mRNA is the message that's translated to make the protein. And by giving just that message and not having to make all of the protein, they're much, much faster to design and they're much, much faster to make. And so that's just basically the difference, is that you can design vaccines much more quickly. We had the sequence for this in the middle of January, and they were able to pick the piece that they should be targeting and get the vaccine designed and start working on it in a matter of days.
Yeah, these vaccines were created in record-breaking time, as you say, less than a year. What are the factors that make that possible?
So the biggest factor that makes that possible is that money was no limit. And so all of the things that are normally very expensive and risky steps in developing a vaccine, you normally don't do those all at once, because you don't have the money to commit to doing every possible thing. So let's say you're trying a bunch of different ways of making vaccines, and they all need different factories and they all need different production lines. Normally, you'd wait to see which of your vaccines worked best, and then you would make a factory that was able to use that technology. But that's what we did here was different. We just basically paid up front to do all of the kinds of manufacturing lines that you would need, and also to do all of the logistics and the coordination of clinical trials simultaneously with many, many people at once everywhere. So it's not that the science part of it was rushed. It's that we were able to do all of the logistics and all of the manufacturing capabilities, and all of that was just scaled up massively and at a potential loss for investing money in a factory that might not be needed, rather than really anything being rushed in the way the science was done.
Yeah, so basically opening up the coffers, doing anything at any cost to get this vaccine to market. You study viruses. That's, you know, your life work. How has the pandemic looked from your vantage point as a scientist?
Oh, that's a tough question. Well, it's hard because you hoped it wouldn't be this bad, because we knew what to do is the hard thing. Mm-hmm. It's been really hard as a virologist to watch all of the numbers and what's happening to the healthcare workers and just to everybody in every facet of life. When, I mean, you always knew as a virologist that there could be a pandemic and it could be really bad. But I have to say, I didn't predict that we would elect as a country not to use the simplest, easiest measures uniformly. The idea that, you know, we could all wear masks and that would cut transmission hugely. I think the thing that was so surprising was just that people, there didn't seem to be a good communication or understanding that we're all in this together. And that when you decide to take a risk and to go to a bar, to not wear a mask, you're not just risking your own health. You can say, well, I'm happy to take that risk and I'm young and I think that I'll be fine. And statistically, you will be, though the long COVID symptoms are nothing to sneer at. But you're not just gambling your own life. You're gambling on your kid's kindergarten teacher, and you're gambling on your dentist mother that they live with, and you're gambling on the immunocompromised kid of your classmate.
And Emily, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. Emily Bruce, faculty scientist at the University of Vermont. News update is next. Municipal governments are budgeting for 2021 and beyond, and that means tough trade-offs and financial pressures like never before. We're looking at what the budget process may be like for cities, towns, and villages here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National League of Cities surveyed about 900 city governments last month. More than two-thirds said their financial health has been negatively affected by COVID, and if Congress doesn't pass another stimulus, they'll continue to face dire economic conditions. How is your municipality's budget outlook? What services will be cut? It's 800-642-1234. Kurt Witinski is Deputy Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Kurt, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you.
So earlier this year, the league predicted that cities, towns, and villages would lose about $400 million in revenue due to the pandemic. Where do things stand now?
Well, things didn't turn out as dire as we had thought in those early months of the pandemic. There are a variety of reasons for that. First, expenditures were not quite the expenditures on dealing with the pandemic weren't as great as we had thought. And then federal government CARES Act dollars that came to the state of Wisconsin and then that were distributed to municipalities helped out substantially. Now, on the revenue side, there were communities, I would say, that were more dependent on room tax dollars, which is basically a sales tax on staying in a hotel. Those communities were hit a little harder, like, for instance, City of Madison, that was dependent on hosting business conferences and other things downtown. Those business conferences didn't happen.
Yeah.
Hotels weren't filled, and their revenue was definitely hit as a result. But not all communities around the state, and you know, there's a great variety and great sizes of different communities around the state were affected in the same way. It didn't end up being as dire as we thought it would be.
Yeah, I mean, that's one funding pot there with those hotel tax dollars. But, you know, can you kind of break down the main sources of revenue that local governments have to rely on?
Sure. So local governments in Wisconsin, and I'm talking about cities and villages and towns for the most part. We represent cities and villages. Counties are a little bit different. Cities and villages rely on property taxes and state aids and then some minor sources of revenue like fees or, basically that's the breakdown. Property taxes, state aids like shared revenue, and smaller collections of fees and other things.
Where do the bulk of local government revenues go? Is there one expenditure that is by far bigger than other areas?
Public safety is by far the largest component of a municipality's budget, so that would include police for the most part and fire departments. Anywhere from 40 to 60%, depending on the municipality, is of a community's budget is police and fire. And then public works is probably second.
contact tracing has been huge in the pandemic. Do you see in your crystal ball that public health will emerge as a much larger spending area, spending piece in the future?
I think hopefully we're all kind of hopeful about this pandemic coming to a slow end in 2021. So I think we're through the worst of the unanticipated extra spending on public health. Hopefully, and counties took the bulk of that because counties have health departments for the most part. There's only about 16 to 20 cities, and mainly cities around the state, that have their own health departments. But certainly we provide police and fire and EMT services, and those all were used to a greater extent than previously because of the pandemic. But we're hopeful that 2021 will be actually less expenditures in those areas than we had in 2020.
Well, let me ask you this. How much do cities and towns depend on the next federal stimulus passing? I mean, what is the trickle down you see there of federal funds?
Yeah. So we are very hopeful that the feds will come through with this fourth stimulus package that they've been negotiating, it seems like, for the last 3 months. And they might actually come up with something in the next week. Here's why we are hopeful that we need it to come through, is because long term, the revenue side of the revenue side of city government is dependent on state government. And if state government's sales tax and income tax revenues and other sources of revenue are down in the next couple of years, which it could very well be the case, and it seems to already be the case as we're seeing that the state has a very challenging budget coming up, we're worried that the state, in order to make its budget work, will reduce funding in state aid programs that go to municipalities. And the federal dollars are critical to maybe making that less likely to happen, as the state can get some money from the feds, and if some of that money also trickles down to cities and villages and replaces some of the lost revenue, like on room taxes and stuff like that, that'll be, obviously help us all bridge through this pandemic and the after effects of it.
We're talking about city budgets for 2021 and beyond with Kurt Witinski. He manages the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. What does your local city or village budget look like for the new year? What do you agree or disagree with on what spending should be prioritized? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kurt, where do property taxes for revenue fit into this budget picture? What has that income look like?
Well, one thing about property taxes, nobody likes to pay them, right? They always come in December. You get your bill in December, and you got to pay their big chunk or spread it out over anywhere from 2 to 4 payments over the next 9 months. But the beauty of property taxes is that it's a stable revenue source for cities and villages. So, property taxes are paid on the basis of the value of your home or your business, and the tax rate is applied to that value, and you get your tax bill and people pay those. That is in contrast to, in many places around the country, many cities rely on sales tax revenue, which is why you cited at the beginning of the half hour here the National League of Cities study saying how 2/3 of cities across the country have been affected negatively by the pandemic and with respect to their finances. Many of those are relying on sales taxes, which obviously took a hit during the pandemic. Less people were shopping, going out to restaurants, things like that, and sales taxes took a nosedive, especially through the summer. That didn't happen for cities and villages in Wisconsin. So the property tax is more stable and more dependable source of revenue. Now, it is true that since the pandemic started in March through October, maybe there were some delays in paying property taxes by some property owners, a higher number of delinquencies or delays in paying. I haven't really seen those statistics yet pan out, if that's been the case.
Yeah.
The numbers are really high or not. But, you know, that is one risk that, you know, people just aren't able to pay their property taxes. But we haven't seen that yet. The timing of the pandemic in March, by March, most people had paid their, you know, the bill they received in 2019 for their by the end of January. I think 70% of people pay their property taxes by March when the pandemic started. So anyway, it's just a long answer to say that property taxes are a stable, dependable source of revenue. That's our main source of revenue for Wisconsin cities and villages.
Another thing that came up from the National League of Cities was just the sheer number of cities that have had to turn to layoffs, furloughs, hiring freezes. What have you seen around Wisconsin?
Right. So we conduct a, you know, Zoom, well, basically it's turned into a video or a Zoom call for pretty much monthly with our finance directors from around the state for communities over 10,000 population. And most said in 2020 that they did not have to resort to layoffs or furloughs. And so I would say that it was an exception. So you saw City of Madison, maybe City of Milwaukee, and very few after that found it necessary because of financial impact of the pandemic to engage in furloughs or layoffs or anything like that. And looking to 2021 as they prepared their, you know, upcoming year's budget, most said that they were able to tap into reserves, rely on the CARES Act to cover additional expenses that were unanticipated, and basically work their way through without having to, you know, prepare a 2021 budget that that worked out without having to engage
cut
in
staff
furloughs or,
yeah,
or layoffs. Yeah.
When you look at Milwaukee, though, and the city's police department downsizing there by 120 officers, what do you see for the large city like Milwaukee, the largest city in,
yeah,
Wisconsin?
Right, right. So I think what Milwaukee's contending with are some more long-term structural issues that have been around a while that may have been exacerbated a little slightly more by the pandemic, but the city has been trying to deal with some of these legacy costs like health insurance for retirees that they've promised over time, and their pension funding and the money they need to from their general fund that needs to go in to support their pension for their employees. They're not,
mm-hmm,
a part of the Wisconsin retirement system. So there's a lot of a range of issues there that they're struggling with, the bigger city struggling with. And there's no doubt that a lack of increase in state aid over the last, you know, decade to a dozen years has played into that.
Yeah.
So the city is not receiving any increases and more like decreases from state aid, which is a large component of their budget.
Well, let's pause there with Kurt Witinski, who is with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, as we look at budget planning for 2021 and beyond. We will be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about local government budgets with Kurt Witinski. He's Deputy Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. The economic fallout from the pandemic has put enormous financial pressure on local governments, and there's a cloud of uncertainty over whether a new round of federal stimulus will make it to states and therefore trickle down to local government, cities, and towns. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. What are your thoughts on local government budgets?
Yeah, you know, I think the guest probably answered the question a little bit, but I know it's very frustrating that I have two kids who go to school and they're getting a completely substandard education, and no one has done anything to decrease costs in the school by cutting labor costs. And then I hear about a financial pressure on local cities and municipalities, and I'm hearing that there's basically nothing done in relation to cutting salaries there, either through layoff or salary cuts. the private sector has been decimated. You know, it's very frustrating to hear that nothing is being done, but yet they want to keep coming after us for more and more money. It's just frustrating.
So Steve's saying the private sector is taking the brunt of this and the public sector is not. Kurt?
Well, so Steve was talking about school districts. I assume teachers are still teaching, whether it's, you know, online or not. I mean, they still have the same amount of staff that they've had before, so they still have the same costs. You have to pay the staff and pay their benefits. Public sector continues to perform the jobs that the public wants. People want their police and fire. They want their roads to work. So, yeah, we need people to do that, and we need to pay people to do that. So I think the taxpayer is getting a good deal, actually. I mean, when you look at all the costs that are attributed to the public services, critical public services, we're trying to be as efficient as we possibly can while continuing to provide what people want and need.
Is there a balancing point for how much debt a local government can carry, you know, even though they need a balanced budget, but how much like bond right. debt or pension debt that they can carry on their books?
Right. Yeah, well, there's a constitutional limit on how much debt a community can take on.
Okay.
And it's it's maximum 5% of their equalized value. And most communities stay well below that, and they keep an eye on it. And you're right, they don't want there's thresholds below which they want to keep their debt service payments, how much they're paying off with debt out of their general fund. And that has been creeping up over the course of the last, 10 to 12 years where we've been under levy limits. So the state imposes limits on how much a community can raise its property tax, increase its property tax levy. The total amount of property taxes they collect each year are limited by how much that can increase from one year to the next by state law. As a result, some communities over time have been able to increase their property taxes, even at the rate of inflation, turn to borrowing because the amount of property taxes we collect to pay debt is exempt from those levy limits.
Okay.
So there's this, there's this bizarre effect of levy limits to induce more borrowing by cities and villages because the taxes you collect to pay debt off are exempt from those.
We're talking with Kurt Witinski, who is the head of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. We're looking at how local governments around Wisconsin are shaping their budgets for next year and beyond amid the pandemic. Taking your questions, your thoughts, and what your city and town is facing, your village is facing at 800-642-1234. Kurt, one of the questions that you ask as a starting point for a budget is that environmental scan, what is going on around us for looking at how to start a budget? What are those conversations like, that environmental scan, as you reach out and talk with cities and villages?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the first question communities ask themselves when they're preparing their budgets, and this process starts, by the way, for many communities in the summertime, and then for, your smaller communities, probably in August and September. And the conversation is, well, what do we need to continue to do in the coming year that we're doing now, and how much will that cost? Will it, will the cost of that rise? And if so, kind of estimate how much. And when you figure out what's the cost to continue the basic services we're doing right now. Libraries are open this amount of time, police, fire, streets need to be plowed. So all that stuff, we figure out this is the cost of doing that right now. Is there anything else we can anticipate that we'll need to do on top of that? Nobody anticipated this pandemic when they prepared their budget in 2019 for 2020. So that caught everyone by surprise. So I'm sure there's some, there's also reserves that communities keep. So they set aside some dollars, try to every year, and say, okay, if something comes up like this pandemic, we can turn to that for paying the extra expenses we hadn't anticipated. So that's kind of the, you know, at its most basic level, the discussion that occurs.
Have communities been dipping into their reserves, if they have them at all?
Yes. Yes. I think that's one, factor for why communities were able to put together their 2021 budgets this fall and now this winter, without, you know, too much of a, you know, effect on staff size and stuff like that. They were able to dip into their reserves, which, according to, you know, some studies by the Wisconsin Policy Forum, that community reserves prior to maybe the last year had been increasing at a fairly, you know, small but steady rate over the last 5 to 6 years. So communities found themselves with some reserves that they could use for exactly this type of situation, where an unanticipated event reduced their income, their revenue, and caused some additional expenditures. So they're able to dip into their reserves. And so, yeah, I would say a fair amount of communities did use their reserves and had reserves to use.
I want to look quickly here at the city of Bayfield, our state's smallest city, population about 500. Next year's budget has been cut by 10%, is about $1.8 million. What financial challenges has the city been facing?
Yes, so Bayfield is a city that relies a lot on tourism, and their summer population and the that they have to serve with all the city services is much higher than it is for the rest of the year, and is much higher than the base of property taxes payers that actually live there. So they have this fairly unique situation where they have to deliver services like a much larger city, but have a property tax base of a city of, what is their population? Something like 590 or something like that.
Fraction of the size. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the dilemma they face, and they are unable to tap into something like a sales tax. They may have the tourism special tax that is available for tourism communities. I'm not sure if they do or not, but they don't have just a broad sales tax like you know, Dane County or some of the most of the counties in the state of Wisconsin have a 1% or 0.5% sales tax. That's not a source of revenue that's available to Bayfield. So part of the problem they face is what many communities around the state face, but only at a higher degree. They're limited sources of revenue. And then when the property tax really can't provide the amount of revenue necessary and state aid doesn't rise to the level necessary, then they're really left with the difficult situation that Bayfield's finding itself in, unable to pay for the staff and services that are necessary for most of the summer.
Kurt, thank you for joining us.
Yes, my pleasure, Kate. Anytime.
Kurt Witinski, Deputy Executive Director for the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Just ahead, President Trump has left his mark on the Republican Party, but where does the GOP go from here? We talk with longtime conservative pundit Charlie Sykes is on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.